All right, we're going to call the House Finance Committee to order. The time is 2:50. Let's see, for the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Co-Chairman Chenault, Representative Parker, Representative Wyrick, and Representative Jewell. Apologize for the delay. The floor ran over today, and the co-chairman here called a conference committee meeting. So. We only have one item today on today's schedule, just a small one, 110 pages long. House Bill 141, or excuse me, Senate Bill 141. House Bill 217, if you're here for that, we hope to take that up tomorrow. So everybody was here for 217. Where we're at on SB 141, let's see, Ms. Cunningham, could you please come to the table? As you know, we spent most of the day Saturday on public testimony, Senate Bill 141, and public testimony is closed. We will allow some testimony. I think the Teamsters did not have an opportunity to testify Saturday. Rose Calamaritis, is that the correct name? Calamaritis, okay. That's good. So we'll take her testimony. Let's do that later. I think what we'll do, we'll let Ms. Cunningham here explain the new CS that everybody hopefully will have. And we'll need a motion to adopt that. We'll have Representative Seaton from the State Affairs Committee comment on the changes that were made from the State Affairs Committee to our current CS. And then I'd like to allow some time for Senator Stedman to comment how it's changed from when it left the Senate. So we can just kind of see how this bill has evolved to the point where it's at currently in the CS. So, is there anything else to come before the committee before we start down this path? Representative Hoggart?
Yes,
sure.
Please. This is the C version of the bill.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 141, reference number 24-LS0637 /C Charlie as a working document.
Okay, that's did you say Craver 426-05?
And that would be the Craver 426-05 day, sir.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Can I object so that we can hear what the difference is? Or do you want to have that discussion? I mean,
I don't know if you need to object. If we have it before us, then we can discuss it. Is there another version you prefer rather than this CS? Or
well, if I understand the version that's in front of us, and that's just with the real tiny time to take a look at it, we basically stripped out almost everything that the State Affairs had done to it.
Sure.
But I want to know what those changes are.
Okay, yeah, we can allow your objection so that you can hear the changes, and hopefully you'll keep your objection with as we go along. Ms. Cunningham, what were the changes in a nutshell?
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Co-Chairman Meyer. And before I begin a description of the changes in the House Finance version, I just want to preface my statements by saying I am not an actuary, and I am not a well-scholared person in retirement systems and benefits. So we do have people here, Representative Seaton, Senator Stedman, and also Ms. Melanie Milhorn from Department of Administration to answer more technical questions that I may not be able to entertain or to answer. In the House Finance version of Senate Bill 141, the first change that occurred is the contributions by employers. The percentage contribution to medical was reduced from 3.75% to 1.75%.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If she could point it out in the version. Yes.
It is on page 15. Lines 14 through 24. That section pertains to TERS.
These are changes within the proposed new defined contribution plan. These are not changes to the existing TERS plan.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that is correct.
Thank you very much.
And page 82.
And one thing, Mr. Chairman, sir. These are changes, again, that exist in this C version that are different than the State Affairs version.
Through the chair, Representative Weirock, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And page
82
through 83, contributions by employers. That's the public employee retirement system. And also the percentage contribution to the HRA was raised from 2% to 3%.
And what page is that on, I'm sorry?
Page 58.
Mr. Chairman, does everybody have this?
Yeah, I was going to ask, do we have a side-by-side that we could...
There is a side-by-side available. And
no, I didn't have one.
I didn't have one, and...
I'm old.
We're making copies.
Yes, copies are being made prior to the meeting, so we should have them.
I think you can go ahead and go through the changes, okay. And then once we get the side by side in front of us, then we'll go over it again so that we know what the changes were and where they're at in the body of the bill. And while we're here, let's Representative Kelly and Representative Crawford.
Yeah, she's going through them now.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Cunningham.
Okay, the changes that were made to the medical program of the bill was the requirement that a person retire directly from the system. That was a change that was made in the House State Affairs version of the bill, and in the House Finance version, we eliminated the requirement to retire directly from the system. So, for an example, I'm 28 years old, employed by the state of Alaska. I work until age 30 and then go into a private sector. I would, at age 65, I would be qualified to retain my medical benefits because I did have 10 years of service in, although I did not retire directly from the state of Alaska when I did retire.
Are we still on page 58?
Now we're on page 25.
Okay. Can I go back to, what did you, catching up to that part?
Okay, sure.
What was on page 58 that I should know?
The increase to the HRA from 2% to 3%. I can give you a line number, just one moment.
Yep, that'd be helpful if we get a page and a line number. It'll help once we get the site.
And are you going to give it on the X version? Is that?
Oh, there at the line 2.
Yes, lines 1 through 3. Pertaining to the increased.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
And then, okay, so the section you were talking about is now?
Page 25, you said?
Page 25.
So, one other.
So you're working off of an X version?
No.
No, C.
C version.
So you're working off the C version?
Yes,
C version.
Sir.
Okay, but it's referring to what you got rid of off of the X version.
I'm explaining, through the chair, Representative Holm, I'm explaining the changes that are incorporated into the House Finance version, which is the C version.
Well, from the State House version. I think that's what Representative Holmes is asking.
Yes.
It's a Davis committee substitute for this committee.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Go ahead and pass out the side-by-sides. Okay, what page were you on now?
Page 25.
Okay, thank you.
It'll be line 13.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what line?
Well, the lines that this elimination of the requirement pertains to would be the eligibility requirements to receive medical benefits. In the House State Affairs version, there was a requirement that a person retire directly from the system. In the House Finance version, that requirement is eliminated.
So the state affairs version said 30 years of service and you got to retire out of the system. We say 10 years, even if you've done something in the interview, but have to be 65 to retire.
That is correct. To the chair.
Okay, any other questions on that? Okay.
The next section, or the next change, is also can be found on page 25, line 13. And actually, this one is a big piece of it. That actually,
when you start saying what you're saying there, Susan, what are you referring to? Are you going from? I'm just trying to catch up with you here. You going from this sheet and then going to a site in here? Is that how you're
yes,
doing?
Yes, I am.
So, so would you call out where you are on the file? I think we're all behind you to one degree or another here, and we need to catch you. And
I
maybe
am on,
we need to start over.
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I am on access to medical coverage and the normal retirement age.
And that's on page.
Okay. That's on page 2 of 7.
Where is that?
It's on page 26.
On the version comparison, what page?
It's on page 104.
Okay, well, let's.
We have
rehearsed this. Let's take a break here. For Eddie.
Okay.
Go like in the first one here and go through it?
That's what I've been doing. This.
So you started on page 16?
That's. Okay. Under the defined contribution retirement account, there was no changes made in the House Finance version.
It says on the sheet it increases the employer contribution 1% from 11.5 to 12.
Through the chair, Representative Croft. On the far right hand side column that contains the changes to that are incorporated into the finance version, and there was no changes that were made to the House Finance version from the previous version of the bill.
Which is the CS for Senate Bill 149, right?
That's correct.
No changes.
We're back.
Yeah.
Representative Kelly's right. We're backing more and more up until we get back. But so this is original Senate Bill, and Senate Finance is the next column. Then State Affairs House, and now House Finance on the phone.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah, I apologize.
We've got too many versions here, but that's okay. We're just focused on, right now, we're just focusing on the last two columns. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
So, under the contribution details, which is the next category, the changes that occur in the House Finance version are the contributions from the employers, which can be found on the following pages, 15 and page 83, in the line referenced on the sheet. It decreases the medical contribution from employers from 3.75% to 1.75%, and it increases the HRA contribution from 2% to 3%.
Go ahead, Representative Croft.
Under the contribution details, the original Senate version had 8%, and now in State Affairs and continuing in this bill, we are keeping the existing employee contribution rate.
That's correct, through the chair.
And the employer contribution rate is the difference between a member contribution. It's what it is now. The difference between what you need and what the employees contractually or otherwise are putting in is what the employer here is going to have to pay. That's the employer contribution rate line.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So what is the 3.7% you're talking about? That's on the base salary?
Through the chair, that is correct.
And that's not retirement, that's medical.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Then, now that we've caught up, now maybe get to substantive questions.
Okay.
Why go down from 3.75 to 1.75 and the other 2 to 3 change?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Croft, I think I can answer that on very surface level. And that would actually be a good question that maybe we can discuss with Melanie Milhorn or Senator Burkstead. My understanding of this is, and this actually pertains to another part that we will get to. I don't want to jump ahead and lose anyone. But that the state affairs version established the eligibility age as 60 months prior to the age eligibility of Medicare. So that would mean a person would be eligible at age 60 to start receiving retirement and medical benefits, for medical benefits. In this version, and in discussions that we had, we thought that it may be more beneficial to a retiree who retires at age 65. We all know that retirees are on a very limited and strict income, that the benefit actually comes after the retirement age of 65, not 5 years prior to.
Okay, and it's fine for you to say that it would be better for other witnesses to talk about it. I understand that clearly, but the total amount we're contributing, is this purely for medical or both for medical and retirement purposes? In that last line on page 1 of the summary. Yeah, it goes from 8.25 in the Senate versions up to 10 and then back down to 9.25. And the components are to DC account, to the defined contribution account, to medical, and to the health retirement account?
Yes.
Yeah, and so those last two are places to save for medical costs, and the first line is the places to save for retirement purposes. So this is the total retirement, and the effect of the changes from the House State Affairs is to have less total savings for medical by 1%.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that's the way the numbers add up to me as well.
Okay. Now I know what we did. We can talk later about whether it was a good idea.
Yeah, very good.
Okay. On to page 2. Nothing in the House Finance Committee substitute changed as far as the vesting requirements.
5-year vesting in every version of the bill 6. And I apologize for...
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. Things stay the same. So we'll go on to medical?
To the medical program. It removed the requirement to retire directly from the system. We've been over that change. The second box down under medical benefits, it changed from the 60 months prior to Medicare eligible age back to age 65, which is the Medicare eligible age, with 10 years of service or at any age after either 25 years for a peace officer or firefighter or 30 years for all others.
a question.
The Medicaid eligible age is 65, so when we say the 60 months to, it's a long way of saying in most circumstances 60 was the same. Why do they say it that way? Are there some exceptions in the Medicare eligible retirement age?
And through the chair, Representative Croft, I think that'd be an appropriate question for Representative Seaton, because that was a change that was made in this State Affairs Committee.
Okay, we'll hold that one.
The next change that occurred in the House Finance version was the retiree share of medical premium was increased from an increment of 3% to 5%. So from 10 to 14 years, it would be 30% that the person would be responsible for paying on their premium. 15 to 19 years of service would be 25%. 20 to 24 years would be 20%. 25 to 29 years would be 15%. And 30 years over would be 10%.
I apologize, but just on each of these.
Let's understand. Go ahead.
So this is a type of, copay, I guess is the wrong word. This is what we're going to ask the retirees at their retirement. So they've already reached retirement, but we're going to ask them to pay a certain percentage of the premium for that insurance, and it goes down the longer you've been in service.
To the chair, that is correct, Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, if we go to page 3. In that first box, a section was deleted that pertained to medical coverage for dependent children. An amendment was made in the House State Affairs Committee, and it provided that only a dependent child who was, I guess, born or thereafter a person or who was born to an eligible recipient, if that child was alive during the recipient's years of service, that's the only way that they would be able to qualify for dependent coverage. There is actually a section in the bill that covers this in kind of less of a confusing manner. Just give me one second. It's on page 26, lines 5 through 7. It states that the retiree major medical insurance plan coverage elected by a surviving spouse of an eligible member under the section covers the surviving spouse and the dependent children of the eligible member who are dependent on the surviving spouse.
This was purely a duplication, you think? This doesn't have any substantive change?
It doesn't have any substantive change. It just, the change reached too far from where the representative who made the amendment wanted to go. The representative was trying to clarify that children of a surviving spouse, like from a second marriage, if the surviving spouse was to get remarried, that their dependents would not be qualified for coverage.
You got me there now. If I'm the employee and I marry somebody and then I marry somebody else and that somebody else has kids, they're not covered, those kids?
If you are the employee, if you're the eligible...
Somewhere the rule of perpetuities comes in here, I know. It's always a law school trick question.
If you are the eligible member and you die, your spouse will have benefits and your children. If your spouse gets remarried and that individual has children, those children and that spouse would not be covered.
Okay.
That's why you're doing this, not me.
Would you like to do this?
<Good luck.
laughs> We do hire them smarter.
Yes. That's why we look smart. We have smart people.
Okay.
So the first question you asked on the day, it isn't, are you tier one anymore? It's
something else.
Spousal rights.
Okay. The next change that occurs that we've already covered in the House Finance CS is that the employer contributes 3% of annual average employer's group compensation to the health reimbursement arrangement, the HRA. And we discussed that when we were looking at the employer contributions on page 1 of the matrix. The next change that occurred in the House Finance version, it allows a 10-year window for terminated, non-vested people to return to service to receive their health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA. However, when they return to service, their account record will be restored, but without interest or other adjustment to the HRA.
And the thought there was that by keeping them longer than 10 years, it's a burden on the...
It could be an administrative burden on Division of Retirement Benefits, yes.
And that's up from 5 years that was in.
Mr. Chairman, yes. In the Senate Finance version, they did have a 5-year window. In the House State Affairs, they removed that 5-year window and kept it unlimited. And then the House Finance version is kind of a compromise from unlimited to 10. On page 4.
Yes, Reverend Jewell.
No, that was good. Thank you.
That's okay. Okay, take it. Continue.
Now this gets a little bit easier for me to discuss. The board structure. There was a number of amendments that were made to the finance version. The first, it returns it to 3 non-beneficiaries and 1 from PERS and 1 from TERS. It adds language regarding PERS and TERS members, saying that these 2 individuals on the boards may be selected from a list of nominees put forward by the bargaining unit. So PERS may submit a list of nominees to the governor for appointment, TERS may submit a list of nominees to the governor for appointment.
May, but may. They don't have to select from that pool. The governor does not.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that's correct. It is may.
And is there any requirement of legislative confirmation?
I believe it is appointment with confirmation by the legislature. No, I'm sorry. It is not appointment by the governor, confirmation by the legislature. It's appointment by the governor.
And in prior versions, through the chair, it had been appointments from the employees, if you will. It had elections or other mechanisms to get representatives from the cover. Now it's there's none of that requirement. There's this sort of option to go from a list submitted by the bargaining units, but there's no election, so direct route, and there's no mandate that they have to do it from that list.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that's correct.
Yeah. I think the hope here was to try to get someone that has expertise in this area, not necessarily somebody who gets elected may not have the expertise, but you know, this is stuff that we can talk more about.
Okay, and I'm not trying to debate it here. I'll get it set and then we'll debate it later. And this recognized competence requirement that has been in and out of various, is it in this version?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In the House Finance version, that appointed trustees must be eligible for an Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. This was added back in from the Senate Finance version. Also, the terms of the board members was changed. In the State Affairs version, they had 6-year terms with a maximum of 2 consecutive terms with a 1-year break required. And in the House Finance version, it's 4-year terms with a maximum of 2 consecutive terms with a 1-year break required. And there was also a requirement for the board to annually evaluate the employer rate for medical insurance to make sure that it's adequate to cover the projected cost. And there was also an increase in the per diem for board members from $150 a day to $400 per day. And this change mirrors the per diem rate that the Permanent Fund Corporation Board currently receives.
Not like the legislature.
To the chair, Representative Coleman is correct.
All right, we're not going to go there. Careful. Yeah. Okay. Question. Is that all the changes? Page 7? Okay.
Page 7.
Page 7?
Wait a minute. That's the next changes from the State Affairs.
The Department of Labor and Workforce Development has changed all of the positions at ABTEC to non-certificated positions and has required that certificated teachers participate in TERS even though they're employed in a non-certificated position. And it opens the door to discrimination lawsuits, and so we deleted this section.
In a nutshell, that's the changes, correct? You did very well.
In a nutshell.
Somebody just had a birthday last night, or yesterday.
Much older, did they?
Yeah, that's it.
Wiser, not older. Wiser.
Mr. Chairman, and in my opening remarks, I did say that there was individuals here from the Department of Retirement and Benefits, okay. The Department of Administration, the House Finance or the Senate Finance sponsors to answer questions that I may not have been able to cover in this brief overview of the changes in the House Finance version.
Well, why don't we at this time, let's get the State House Chairman's perspective. He's here. We're fortunate to have Mr. Representative Seaton with us. Representative Seaton, we'll put you in the hot seat.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Have you had a, I know you've been out of town on some unfortunate business, but have you had a chance to kind of see all the changes and the differences?
Somewhat. I just got the side-by-side here, and there's, you know, some things that I think we need to point out in there. First of all, I'd like to appreciate the work that you're doing. One of the things that we were doing in House State Affairs was making sure that we accomplished the job of eliminating future unfunded liabilities. And unfortunately, going back to the House or the finance version, we reacquire a number of potential unfunded liabilities in the system. One of those is that a lot of those have to do with the medical system. So let me just quickly, before we go through point by point, talk about those. 141 C creates some unfunded liabilities because it's not collecting enough money to pay for the future benefits. Mercer did their calculations based on the assumptions that people were retiring directly from the system. The change that we have in the House Finance version, that people do not have to retire from the system, Mercer has not made those calculations. That's going to be quite a bit expanding, well, tremendously expanding the pool of potential retirees, and that's not in the calculations of those percentage contributions. And because the version goes back to age 65.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, Director Roth.
Could you repeat that?
Could I what?
You said that what was it that Mercer did not calculate?
Well, for 141, Mercer made their calculations based on the post 65 numbers of people retiring directly from the system. And what the House Finance version does is eliminates the requirement that you retire directly from the system. So all of a sudden, the pool of people that will have 10 years of service and reach the age of 65 at some time would then be able to retire under this plan. And they would have access to medical subsidy through House Bill 141, whereas the House version said that you had to retire directly from the system, you could have 10 years of service. You could retire at age 60, but you had to have been working for at least 12 months before retiring, which makes sure that you have current employees and people that are employed with the state, not somebody that worked 20 years ago, had 10 years of service, could now, at age 65, under the finance version, can come in and receive medical benefits. And that is an unfunded liability, I believe, because you're not in that window of time collecting any money. The medical benefits that are under 141 are significantly more post 65 than what we have under the House State Affairs version. And I'll go through that in a minute, because it's reversed the numbers. It's increased the employer contribution to 70% minimum from the employer, even if you only had 10 years of service, whereas the House version has you, we have 30% subsidy, increasing 3% a year up to 90%. But the finance version starts at 70% and goes up to 90%. So there's quite a difference there, and we can go through that in just a moment.
You're bringing in the 70, but let's just stay on the first point. Because the prior versions, and it's gone in and back out and in and years and out in the House Finance version, said you had to retire from the system.
That's correct.
Somebody starting at 30 years old is going to be relatively unlikely that they're going to last the entire time, and they know when we hired them, I know when I sign on, I wouldn't be covered at all under medical under this plan unless I lasted, ran out the entire clock, got to full retirement, stayed 30 years in state service?
Through the chair, no, 30 years is retiring directly from the system, or 10 years and reaching the retirement age. So if you have less than 30 years, you have to retire directly from the system. Let's say you have 12 years. If you had 12 years when you were 22 to 34 years of age and you leave,
you're just out.
You're out. That's correct.
And you have to find your medical coverage someplace else.
That whoever your employer is for the next 30 years of your employment lifetime, yes. And the finance version says that, oh, if you work 12 years, you know, 30 years ago, when you reach 65, you now get subsidy in the healthcare system. The calculations that Mercer made were not based upon that. They were based upon people retiring directly from the system. So if you had less than the 30 years, anybody with 30 years, that's considered retiring directly from the system.
I got to either work 30 years or have started my employment late enough that I can have some confidence I'm going to retire, that I can retire out of it at a normal retirement age.
That's correct, or through the chair, or come back and work some more, you know, when you're 55, 60, you might come back in and get rehired in the system and have cumulative experience of more than 10 years. But you would have to retire directly from the system. You wouldn't be able to accumulate 10 years when you're, like I say, 22 to 32 years of age, and then go out and work somewhere else and then come back in at the age of 65 and pick that up. Now, that's another difference between our two plans, and because we considered this going towards a DC plan and a health reimbursement account. You know, the whole philosophy of that is to make it like a defined contribution plan. And what we did in the House State Affairs is say, okay, that's your money in your health care reimbursement account. If you get your 10 years in, you can come back in and that'll be your money and you'll have it, just like a defined contribution plan when you reach that retirement age. The finance version says if you have that 10 years you vest, you lose it.
And this,
so there's healthcare reimbursement account and the medical are two components that can work together, but they're quite different. The medical is an insurance plan that covers you just like regular medical. The healthcare reimbursement account is dollars assigned to a personal account by you. And so House State Affairs treated that like a DC plan and said, if once you vest in that, after you have your years of experience, that your account stays there, and when you retire, you can access that personal account.
This is probably a basic question that everyone here understands, but what is the interaction of the health reimbursement account and the medical set aside by the employer? Do I have to use up my health reimbursement account and then that sort of umbrella coverage after that? How do the two at retirement cooperate to pay my medical expenses?
Through the chair, the healthcare reimbursement account gives you money that you can use for any qualified healthcare expense. You can, and it's different under the bills, but you can retire at 60, basically 60 months pre-Medicare eligible, and use that money to pay your premium, your non-subsidized premium. There's none of that in 141 finance version. In 141 finance version, you have to be 65 before there's any medical benefit. But you can use your health care reimbursement account to pay your portion of that premium, or you don't have to. You can be using it for something else if you have acupuncture treatments for something, or major surgery, or anything that's not, or minor surgery, something that's not covered under the medical plan. You can use your health care reimbursement account as tax-free dollars in and tax-free dollars out for those authorized expenses.
Stay generic for a second before you get to the details so I understand. Okay, so at retirement, at normal retirement, 65, I'll have a health care reimbursement account with a certain amount, and I'll have coverage from my employer. And so ordinary things are covered the way they're ordinarily covered, and I get to use this essentially, the thought is, for premiums or other non-covered medical expenses.
That's correct. You'd have it's major medical that you have, and it's a portion of a subsidy of that. So you can use your health care reimbursement plan to pay your portion of the premiums, any costs, cost sharing? I'm blanking right now. You know, the copay. Your copay, any medical costs that are outside of the major medical plan. Like I said, if you went to an acupuncturist or something, and that's qualified kind of therapy, then you could use it for that, even if it's not covered under the major medical plan. You could use those dollars to make those costs.
How, I appreciate you guys letting me hear that. How is the major medical different from the medical coverage that we have now? Is it, I mean, you can write major medicals that are really just only major, almost an umbrella, I'm only going to cover you for catastrophic. Do we have some definition of what, whether it's going to cover much, not very much, a lot?
Through the chair, the major medical plan is the same.
Same.
The only difference is that right now, we just pick up, the state picks up 100% of the tab for you and all your dependents. And into this plan, there is a cost share. Either one. There's different cost sharing, but there's cost share.
The copay is saved, but we weren't asking for any premium to be paid by the employee.
There is premium to be paid by the employee. And the difference in the two plans is that under 141, there's no subsidy base, so that it can grow at whatever rate the healthcare grows at, and we are responsible for picking up that percentage of whatever cost that is. Under the House State Affairs version, which was a defined dollar contribution, we could actually define that because we had a subsidy base that grew at no more than 5% a year. So we can identify what our liability will be in the future because we constrain that cost growth to 5% a year as far as the subsidy base of what percentage we will pay on the subsidy base.
And when we go from 3.75 to 1.75, let's go back and forth in the different versions, that's how much of the employee, that's not employer contribution, that's how much of the employee's pay we're going to take out for this medical plan, and then the 2 to 3 is how much we're going to require them to take out for the health reimbursement plan.
And through the chair, have to get into a little more complicated than that.
Knew it would be. Yeah.
The medical is actually a percentage of your salary. The healthcare reimbursement plan, because there are federal anti-discrimination laws, you can't discriminate between people that are making different amounts of money. That is an amount that is based on the average salary of PERS members, TERS members, PERS others. So there's three different categories under the House bill, and you have to have those as a unit payment. So it's not actually 3% to the HRA or 2% to the HRA, it's 2% of the average salary of that group of people. So
that the employer puts in or that the employee
puts in? The employer is the only contributor to the HRA and to the medical. The employees all goes into the retirement fund itself. And sorry for not going through the chart.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Thank you.
Good discussion.
I needed that general sort of framework.
Okay. I think we all needed it.
Additionally, SB 141, and this was brought up, allowed new dependent coverage acquired after service. This is going to be, or has the potential for being very substantial, because we're looking at a person being employed today, the cost per year, 30 years from now, is estimated to be $54,000 a year is going to be the average cost of medical payments. And what we did is we put a constraint on there so that if you were a retiree, you could not adopt your grandchildren. I mean, you know, it's a huge benefit, or your go through those kind of, we just perceive that there is a large possibility for adoption, which is perfectly fine under the finance version, of greatly expanding the number of people, because if we get to the point where healthcare is as expensive an item, and it has been identified by the employees and the employers as the most important item to them in the retirement package, if we get to those kind of things, we're talking $50,000-$60,000 a year per individual, we can get all kinds of little things going on. So what we did in House State Affairs is we said the people that are covered are spouses and dependents that were acquired or were there when you were in active service, when you were an employee. It's not when you're 80 years old and you decide to acquire some of your family as dependents so that they will have the medical benefit for 20 years. And so that is something that we tried to cover as an unfunded liability.
Okay.
So,
I have a question.
That was described to us as more of a technical contract. You see a substantive difference between state affairs. They both use similar language, but I take it not identical in an important way. Suzanne, on page, it was page 27, lines 8 through 11. Where was the language that we retained that approaches this issue of dependent children? You are off the hook.
She's always ready. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, it's on page 26,
yeah,
lines 5 through 7, and that's under the TERS. Okay. And there's also a section under the PERS section as well. It's the same language.
So, Representative Seaton, where it says on page 26, line 5 through 7, retiree major medical insurance plan covers the surviving spouse and the dependent children of the eligible member who are dependent on the surviving spouse. That language isn't good enough for you because it doesn't say who were dependent at the time of employment.
Through the chair. That's correct. It doesn't say that the surviving spouse or the dependent children are had any relationship to the working history of the employee. And we see this with these huge expensive medical things coming down as being a great potential unfunded liability to the system.
I thought there was language you pointed us to earlier that had something approaching that who were dependent at the time. The TERS, is there a similar PERS provision there?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, yes, it's on page 93. Lines 21 through 23. I think when I was speaking about this change, I indicated that we had deleted that section that was added in the House State Affairs Committee because we felt that it was covered under the current language. And Mr. Chairman, one situation that arises, we heard testimony last Saturday pertaining to death and disability benefits for peace officers and law enforcement agents. And one thing that we'd have to be cautious about would be a police officer or fireman that dies in the line of duty, leaving his pregnant wife and child. Would that child, because that child wasn't alive during the number of service, be counted? I mean, it's a very intricate situation when we're talking about the benefits of surviving spouse and dependents.
Thank you. Like you said, I don't want to debate. I just sure. Understand the context.
Yeah, trying to understand. Okay.
Yeah, and so just to clarify, we saw a huge difference between saying the surviving spouse has dependent children. What we were doing was saying the spouse was also during the term.
Okay. Representative Holman has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question about your comment about you thought it was a great liability. If I understand this correctly, we're talking about a retiree. Most retirees at my age don't have any dependent children and haven't had dependent children for 20 years. So, and I'm not even 60 yet. So I wonder if that really is true. Survivor benefits, you're absolutely correct, I would buy that. But as far as retirees, I don't think so. So I'm kind of confused. If we're going to have people that are going to retire at 60, why would you think that would be a major component?
Yeah, through the chair, when you start actually going through the numbers and find the escalation in healthcare costs is getting to per person being $50,000, $60,000 per year is the medical coverage, is what person would have to be paying for premium for themselves or a child or their spouse. That's per person is the numbers that you inflate over 30 years. What we get is the point of being very careful about what we allow. And if we allow grandparents to adopt their children, their grandchildren, they would then be dependents. We could get into a number of situations where we had marriages at almost at the end of life to allow friends or others to have a very large retirement benefit. I mean, this is when we actually come down and start talking about the numbers and the significance of those numbers and what they mean to what those benefits could mean. What we did is we tried to figure out constraints so that we didn't have people playing games to give those benefits to other family members, and we think that that's a constraint that we wanted to put on. If you have a different way of putting that constraint on, that's fine. But if we don't have any constraint, we just say that anybody you marry and their kids, as long as they're dependent kids at whatever time of life, even if it's just before you're dying, they will have these full medical benefits for their 20 years or 22 years of life. You can get lots of games played, and if we build a system that allows those games, then we cannot fault anybody for taking advantage of those if we build those into the system. So it's not as if it would be fraud if we allow it. I presume that people will take advantage of those things that we allow in the system. So that's that's why we were trying to put these constraints, because we've seen the unfunded liabilities and the potentials, and you can deal with those in your wisdom, but those are what we're trying to do is determine the constraints. So if you don't feel that it's a problem having dependent children at 80 years of old, 80 years or 85 or 90 because you adopted a section, whether they're your extended family or not, then there's no problem having this in there, because you wouldn't be doing but it could prevent some abuses, what we would consider abuses.
Yeah, just can we ask Mercer that question? Because it seems the way the House Finance version has it, it's more fair to the employees. And so the question becomes, is it a negligible, small, medium, or large cost increase? And you said you didn't have Mercer because you had a different approach. But I'd be interested in asking him that question, both on this point and the point you made before, not required to retire from the service. What are the impacts of these? I don't know how we do that, but if it's relatively little, they say, then it's worthwhile doing, and it might not be if it's
and through the chair, we requested that of Mercer. In fact, my staff was on the phone with them today, and then they didn't realize when they had done the original analysis, it was based on retiring directly from the system, and they didn't realize the Senate bill had changed for the House Finance version that did not require that. So their calculations and their percentages are based on retiring directly from the system, and they're going to reassess that and come back, you know, hopefully with some numbers so that we can know what those projected figures are. But when you start talking about 30 years out and saying how will people react, I mean, we just, you know, what we did is tried to assume and look and say, what are we going to allow the system to do? And what do we want the system, what kind of behaviors do we want to allow the system, it within the system? And if we didn't want to allow those kinds of behaviors which would impact the system, we took them out. If you want to build back in so that people can adopt their grandchildren and have those medical benefits paid, then, you know, you can do what's was done here and ignore what we did in State Affairs. So, but that's how we went about trying to limit some of those potential increases in liability that aren't being paid for. In other words, they're not being collected for through the system. I mean, if it's a defined contribution program, as far as the retirement benefit, it doesn't matter because that's the system. But if it's a medical benefit, the medical benefit is a pooled risk portion. And if we allow people to bring in other people that are unanticipated into that pool and cover them, then we create a huge expense on the system that was not anticipated.
We don't know if it's huge. It creates unexpected.
A expense of some sort.
Sure.
Okay.
Just looking through the... if you look at page 2 on the side-by-side, you'll see that there's been a large change here in the in what's happening. What was previously done, and which is done in almost every other state, is that the subsidy by the system starts at 30% with 10 years of experience. And then it goes up. And what it was before was going up from 30% to 90% coverage by the system. Okay, what has happened here is we've changed that so that the retiree has a maximum of 30% share instead of a 70% share. If you only have 10 years in the system under the State Affairs version, you get 30% paid by the employer. If you and you go up by 3% per year, which is basically the same schedule as listed in these categories, and we went to 3% per year so that we didn't have these jumps where you had people making decisions based on jumping to a new class. It meant they could gain some health care benefits every year, 3% per year. Extending, they wouldn't get to one of these classes, such as they'd be in year 15, and now before they would receive any additional health care benefit, they would have to be in the system 20 years to go from 25 to 20. So it would jump in 5% increments, but it's quite a different structure. So if you see 141, it's talking about the employer subsidy is 30%. And then going up by 3% a year to 90. And what's happened in the House and the other is the retiree share is going from 30 to 10. So there's a minimum of a 70% subsidy under the finance version that you have before you. And the problem is that one of the things that was identified in the TIER study is that both employers and employees wanted to have more benefit come to long-term employees. And what this structure does is say, you get almost all your health care benefits. You get 70% subsidy if you're only there for 10 years. And you only go, you go up to, you know, very slowly to the 90%. Whereas in the House version, you at 10 years, you get 30% subsidy if you're only there. But then you go to 90 in a 3% increment per year.
Okay. I'm sorry, Ben, but I had confused the 30 and the 30, because there's a huge difference between what you were explaining. Really, after working for 10 years, being fully vested, my employer is only paying 30% of my... That's not really medical coverage. That's a small participation in something I have the responsibility for. The employer, after 10 years of service and full vesting, is only contributing 30% of my health care premium?
That's correct.
In the middle of it, and we've restored this to the way the Senate started out, which is 30% that I'm responsible for at that time.
Through the chair. Yeah,
I confused those 30s.
Yeah. That's correct. So there is a large difference in those two. One starts off slower, and for longer workers, the longer you work, you go up every year and you gain something. The other is, if you're there for 10 years, you get pretty much all the health care benefits you're going to get if you work there, you know, 30 years. Not quite. You go up from 70 to 90%. But the other has much more incentive to stay working in the system, because you start at 30% and you go up 3% a year up to 90%. So at the end, a long-term employee gets the same 90% coverage. But there's a lot of difference in how you build in the other. Okay. If we look at page 3,
is that something that... Who came up with that change? How did that develop?
I don't know how that change came. The 30% to 90% was what the TIER committee structure was. So the TIER committee that worked on this over the interim, and this is very similar to Colorado and another number of other plans where it starts off at 30% and goes up. Lots of them have increments. Some of them go up to 3% a year. So I'm not sure where the change from the TIER committee plan to the SB 141 plan, where that jump came, instead of being 30% subsidy by the system to 70% subsidy by the system.
Okay, thanks.
The healthcare reimbursement arrangement is, there was quite a bit of difference there, because like I said, we considered that like a DC plan. It's your money. That was the whole object of it. It's a separate account. We wanted to see that being there as an incentive to come back to work. The Senate version had a 5-year, you lose all your money.
We are
on page 3.
I didn't see where that five. Oh, I see. You're on the second to last line.
Yeah, second last line there.
That was on the first page too.
And we removed that 5-year window, and we added the accrued interest. In other words, in the healthcare reimbursement account, the whole idea here was get into individual accounts, whether it was with your retirement benefit or with the healthcare reimbursement account. And if you came into the system, you were in the system, your money was there. If you came back later and work some more so that you did vest, then that money was available to you when you retired. The change that's here is the window has gone to 10 years, so if you come to work when you're 20 and you work for 5 years in the system and you leave, if you leave for more than 10 years, you lose your HRA contribution. The finance version doesn't accrue the interest that that money that's in your account is accruing, even though you come back to work and work for another 15 years. You would, under the version that you have before you, if you don't come back for 10 years, you lost your previous health care account. It's just gone. Under our version, it's there. You come back to work, it and its accrued interest is there with you if you vest in the system, you have 10 years in the system.
It's there forever? I leave and it sits there?
Sure, and I'm sure by regulation they're going to figure out when people are no longer employed. So you're not going to carry it 200 years from now. But essentially through the time that you could, if you came in and worked for 10 years from the time you were 20 to 30, and then you left and were in private employment, and maybe, people do this a lot. Then they come back in through retirement, come back in and work for the state, when they're 50. That health care reimbursement account was just kept track of. It's just in the computer anyway. It's not like you're pumping paper. And then that would be there, being a real incentive to come back into the state service as well.
But in no plan, none of these four versions, did you ever allow to take your health care retirement with you? Take it out, I'm leaving, give me my health care reimbursable account.
That's correct.
And the difference, original one the original Senate version had a 5-year, but it had the same employer. You, in state affairs, left it open, and we are in between the two with the 10-year window, but no interest. Okay, that was explained, but I just got it. Thanks.
Okay, and then if you look over on the next page, number 4, I don't know where this came from under the state affairs version. We never eliminated the competency requirements that were required by the governor. In fact, that was specifically talked about in health in state affairs. So if somehow there's something in there that wasn't the intent of state affairs. State affairs had everyone that was going to be a member had to.
You thought competence was good.
Yeah, we thought competence was good, and that was included in there. The one thing that we did find was that the way that this has been defined and talked about, as far as a person is not a beneficiary, as it's actually written on page 46, line 4 in your current bill, it's beneficiary or member. And under the current version where you can buy back in, that would mean, that would be anybody that had ever worked in any kind of state service, where you were a university student and you were a TA or an RA or something, and you had, if you received anything there, if you were ever with the school board, if you were ever, not school board, but were ever in the school system, if you were ever employed as a youngster, you were then ineligible, no matter what your criteria, if you were ever in the legislature, if you were ever a legislative staffer, preclude you from being a public member of the Persian Service Corps. We think that within Alaska, that's going to may be very difficult to find 3 members that fulfill that requirement. We actually went through 2 renditions of getting 2 more members on the board, going to 2 TERS members and 2 PERS members. One was that the bargaining units would nominate 3 to 5 members, and the governor would select from those. And the other rendition that came in later was that those people would be elected by the PERS and TERS memberships. But in no case were we talking about not having to fulfill the competency part. And, you know, you've gone back to three non-beneficiaries, and I hope you'll consider that as far as who would be eligible and how many people would not be eligible in this state.
What's the language you like? So it's on our version, page 46, line 4, may not be a member or beneficiary. You may not be a current member? What did you guys do that was different than that member or beneficiary thing?
Through the chair, what we did was we took that to one member who was basically who'd never been affiliated with Persian Church in any way, has never been employed, isn't a retiree. That's what that means. Okay, that's a member or beneficiary means has never been affiliated with state service, municipal service, schools, anything. So we took that to one member with that category and added one more member of PERS and one more member of TERS. So there would be two members from PERS and two from TERS.
Another way to do it is say those three may not be currently active, or words to that effect. I mean, so you're not doing the prior, you're just, are they currently in the system and accruing time?
That wasn't the state of, through the chair, that was not the state of affairs motion. It was to have more buy-in by the retirees by having two members of PERS and having two members representing PERS. Also on board terms, we definitely wanted to get this as apolitical as possible, and we did not want the way it was currently set up in the Senate version was 9-year, nine members, 3-year terms, which meant that the governor in his first 3 years would replace the entire board. We wanted to go to 6-year terms. First of all, there's really only 7 appointed members because one is the Commissioner of Administration, one's the Commissioner of Revenue. So you have 7 members, but we didn't want to see them all being wholesale replaced within every term that a governor is elected. We wanted to depoliticize it. So we said 6-year term with a maximum of 2 terms consecutive and a year between. So if someone was in there for two consecutive terms, they could be out and could be renominated. So 4 years, which is in your current bill, does not get us there. It means that the governor will replace the entire board. And we were trying to get away from that, from that situation. Let's see, we had a couple other things. On the page 7 of 7, If you look at what we had, was we said if someone was a member of TERS and went from a school district so that they were a teacher, maybe they're a voc ed teacher or something, and then they go to work for the Department of Labor teaching in either Avtec or in Kotzebue or someplace else, they could remain in the TERS system. What happens is we're saying, okay, you're out of TERS and you have to go to PERS. Because we don't require the teaching certificate for you to teach at Avtec. And so what we did is we didn't say that everybody that's at Avtec has to be in TERS, because there's a number of people, whether it's welders, mechanics, or whatever, have experience. And they're coming in from a logging camp because they know maintenance of heavy equipment. And they're not a teacher. They don't have a teaching certificate. They would be in PERS. But if someone was getting hired that was already in TERS, they could remain in TERS. So this is an incorrect characterization of what we did. But what we said is if you were a TERS member, you would remain in TERS. So that was just clarification. And it's taken out here, and you know, will require a separate bill to go through, but there's been quite a bit of testimony about people that are going to teach in, you know, Avtec, Kotzebue, or any of those kind of places that are, we limit the pool of people that we can take there because people that are in TERS now all of a sudden have to jump and go through, and it's all different amounts of time and everything else.
Representative Hoffman has a question. Thank you. Paul, as sincerely a representative evening. I sincerely appreciate the time and effort you got into this. Your knowledge of the inner workings of this bill are absolutely amazing. I guess you spent a little time there.
How's it feel to have it go?
We all know about something in our lives. The honest question is that looking at these alternatives or the things that you've just fleshed out, I think, extremely well for us. They presume, I mean, the sheet in front of us and the options on the board, I presume that we have already made the decision to go to a major, make the major break and go from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. But that, just recognizing that, is a big issue that actually predates or the sheet. Presuming that we're just looking at these options across the sheet, would you characterize, or in your experience on looking at all of these and put a tremendous amount of time, the differences between the Senate Finance 141 that came over to your committee, the effort that your committee, or the work product of your committee, and the current work draft C that's in front of us? I mean, obviously, it's a bit increases. Significant differences, but are any of these, would you characterize these as legitimate issues and legitimate judgment calls for us to make on picking one or the other? Or are there any of these that we could really sort of take off the table and say, I mean, there's just one that is, something's absolutely wrong and the other one's clearly right? Or again, or are these all legitimate judgment calls on here?
Well, through the chair, Representative Hawker, I believe they're legitimate judgment calls. However, I did want to point out that, we worked very hard on trying to constrain potential future unfunded liabilities. And I don't believe that the current CS that you have before you addresses a number and actually insinuates in the program potential future unfunded liabilities, which is the whole reason why we're addressing this issue. And so I think that that's one concern. Also, I think that if you look at the bottom line numbers, the testimony that we had from people, employers, was that they were not concerned with the normal cost rates that they were currently paying. What they're concerned about is this escalation, that they've been able to live with those rates. It's this unfunded liability, the insecurity of what's going forward. And so I ask you to take a look at the bottom line, if you look at the direct defined contribution portion, and do we want to make this a cheap program? Because remember, retirement benefit program is for one purpose, and that is to attract and retain people. Employers said medical benefits were the most important thing. We've had lots of testimony saying you have to have, in a defined contribution program, there are two things you have to worry about. One is you have to have adequate funding. I don't see any reason at all to go down below our historic normal cost rates. We've had normal cost rates of 11.1% in TERS and 10.86 in PERS for the last 25 years. And that's our average of all of those. And so for us to design this new plan and then make it so that we only have an 8% contribution rate means that we are not going to adequately fund a system that's going to be attract and retain people. That's my opinion, and that's what...
worsening our situation by making the wrong decision on these alternatives.
Well, it's an amount of cost that we are willing to put in, and I think that we need to make sure that we have adequate contribution rate. And so, I don't think that we should look just at the bottom line on page one and say, well, let's see, the first plan was a total employer of 8.25, and so that's good when our average normal cost has been 10 to 11. And that's what we have tried to put in, and in fact, that's one of the few things that the House Finance version kept, was we put in a floor that the employer couldn't contribute less than 11% to TERS and 10% to PERS, so we didn't have these radical swings over time and get these unfunded liabilities. Well, so I'm not sure where we go, because we have a employee contribution rate with these changes of, you know, of less.
You mentioned, or recognize this, obviously, certainly conventional wisdom, and that's the challenge here is not doing the normal cost of maintenance of the non-medical benefits. It's really the escalating cost that is being driven primarily by medical benefits. Did your committee take the, or have the opportunity to consider air contrast alternatives that might, again, back to an alternative to the entire idea of moving to a fund contribution plan, but looking at addressing that escalating cost, perhaps even within the existing plans, and what alternatives we might have available to us?
Through the chair, oh, we did. We looked at the TER models from the TER committees. And, you know, we are under severe constraint that most other states aren't, because of our constitutional obligation of not being able to change the benefit package. I mean, most other states are able to do that and have done that. Most other corporations have done that. So what we looked at was trying to start from scratch, and we used the basis, the tier models, but there was A and B, and so that's where we generated from.
It seems like everything is presupposed to the fund contribution plan here. Did we really look at the downstream consequences of making, you know, a new tier? Yes, obviously, if we make changes from point forward, we must, it's not like creating a new tier or a new world for incoming employees, but we look at consequences of structuring new tiers within defined contribution, the defined benefit model.
Through the chair, actually, most of our stuff is not based on defined contribution. If you look at our medical model, it is not necessarily a defined contribution. It's a defined dollar, so that you have some constraints on it, but it could be used in a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. And also the HRA is...
We could potentially incorporate some of the good work done here in the medical model inside a defined benefit plan, as well as making this radical shift of all plans to the statement that it is a defined contribution.
Through the chair, the model that we came out for the retirement package with defined contribution, the medical model that we generated is not a defined contribution model. It's a defined dollar amount. So it is building the constraints onto the subsidy that we're going to provide. But it's not a defined contribution. The HRA is somewhat a defined contribution. However, it's much more a defined contribution because it stays with the employee through its potential coming back to the state under the state affairs than it is on the version where after 10 years, if you leave employment for 10 years, you lose it all. I mean, that's not really the essence of a defined contribution model. So if you work for 15 years and built up an HRA under the house finance model, and then you were gone and came back 12 years later, all that contribution is lost. And under the House State Affairs version, that was retained in there for you to come back and would build on in future service. So in that respect, our HRA has some more elements of a defined contribution plan, but really the amount of being able to come back and pick up years is also a element of a defined benefit plan as well. Most, you know, I mean, right now we have cumulative service within a defined benefit plan. If you work for 5 years and you leave for 10 years, you come back, that's cumulative service. What is the problem with the HRA in the finance version is it's not cumulative. It goes away, and so I think that's, you know, basically, but that's the healthcare model. And I appreciate all the time.
do you suspect that the testimony so far today has raised or resolved more questions in the mind of this committee?
Well, I, if it's about the CS, I hope to raise more questions.
Okay, so very good. And Representative Seaton, thank you for that explanation. I would like to now ask Senator Stedman to join us and give us his perspective. Let's see, you didn't start this mess. It was is this your bill or Senator?
Jeff Shorter over here. Except for Representative Wyler, of course.
You've been involved with this from its origin, and so maybe you could kind of give us your impression of how it's evolved and what your thoughts are and what you would like to see changed. If,
when I back up a little bit, you know, with just for point of clarification, you know, we started with a Senate Finance Committee bill, which we have, and then it was delivered over to the House State Affairs, and then they did what State Affairs does and review it and amend it, and then now it's at the House Finance Committee, and then they review it, and then they amend it, and the contribution formula for retirement side, there's not really a change there. I want to touch on a couple of the bigger conceptual differences. One of them is how to handle health care, and then the next one will be how to handle the board structure. But if we look at the health care, the philosophical envelope that the Senate Finance Committee evolved into was to have health care for the employee, well, not only during the working years, which I think everybody would agree that we do, but in retirement, and to pick it up, pay the cost at age 65 and through retirement until the death of the employee and the spouse. And then the question is who's going to pay for it? So came in with that tier structure, or almost like a kind of like a vesting schedule, kind of like, but it and that's on page 2, where after 10 years of service the employer would pick up 70% of the premium.
Are you in the matrix?
Yes, I'm working on the side by side. And then at the end of 30 years of service, the employer would pick up 90%. The employee then would be responsible to cover the insurance premium previous to that, previous to age 65. So the health reimbursement arrangement was put in to help not pay it in entirety unless they wanted to, but more of a funding mechanism to partially offset the premiums. The Senate version is a little more expensive dealing with post-employment health care, in that there is more risk shifted to the employer relative to the House State Affairs version after age 65. And so if we can just stop for a minute and talk about age 65 on, and this will I think tie into some of Representative Croft's questions. At age 65, we assume the person has been a good employee, and he has or she has, say, 30 years of service, so the state will pick up 90% of the premium. You know, when you're 65, 75 to 85, you're very unlikely to go back into the labor force, and I don't think it's beneficial for the employer to put the employee in a position where a cost like healthcare costs, which is out of the employee's control, is shifted to, or weight-wise of the cost, shifted more to the employee than what would have been expected over the working lifetime. So regardless, at age, under the Senate bill, regardless of what happens to health insurance growth rates in retirement, if an employee works for 30 years, the state will pick up 90% of it. So if the growth rate, instead of being capped at 5% or some other number, if health insurance, or excuse me, health care grows at 8% a year or 9% a year, it makes no difference. The split is 90% to the state or the employer, and we'll refer to the state as the employer, and 10% to the employee. If you shift that burden to the employee and you artificially cap that growth rate, because we don't know what that growth rate is going to be, it becomes less expensive for the employer. But I would argue that the employee is not in a position to be able to respond to cover that. You need it. You need your health insurance when you retire, and especially after age 65. The Senate then did not have the state or the employer pick up the health insurance previous to age 65. So the employee, the ex-employee then would have to pay the premium. The health reimbursement arrangement was put in there as a funding mechanism to either be used in the time frame between, say, when they quit at 55 or 60 and age 65, if it's needed, and after that, if there's some left. It's all employer monies, so it compounds tax-free and comes out tax-free. The Senate initially started out with 1%, then they went to 2%, and I think the House Finance Committee here is at 3%. That is a attractive benefit to the employee, and I'm certainly not going to sit here and recommend that the House Finance Committee lower it. The idea of, you've got to have attractive benefit package. And some of those decisions, should it be 1%, 2%, or 3%, clearly 3% is better and more attractive. I think 1% isn't quite enough, and we looked at it and we bumped it to 2. The cost then of the Senate version is a little more, again, on post-employment health care because of the way it's handled over age 65. The state has more risk. Some would argue may possibly that we have a potential for an underfunded condition. I would argue that technically that is true, but it's much more, it's less likely to ever evolve to a magnitude anywhere near what we're doing today. And we're starting, again, and to reference Representative Hawker, with a new tier, defined contribution, new base of employees. They're going to work 30 years, so we've got to add 30 years from today, and then sometime when they hit age 65. So we got a long time out in front of us. We've had the actuary go in and do the calculations, Mercer, for the contribution.
Can I ask on that?
Yes.
Because I'm sorry, you stayed this longer, and Representative Hopper knows it better, but I'm playing catch up here. We're going to be putting in for 30 years, and then it's building up the fund, if you will, and then they're going to start drawing that 30 years. We have employees in the system now. Is it going to be a totally separate account, as it were? We're going to have new employees pay into this defined contribution and modifications, and that's going to build up so it's funded for when they retire 30 years from now?
Right. All the changes we're talking about here on the healthcare is not for current tiers.
Because it only goes for,
it's only for the new tier, the defined contribution tier. Call it tier 4 or whatever, whatever we want to name. It's a new tier. But currently, there is no employees in there because
we start from zero.
The health reimbursement account is employer money, goes in there, grows at whatever it's going to grow at. Actually, the board will set the rate and pay the rate. The Senate initially had a five-year window. If you terminated, you have 5 years to come back to pick that up. The Finance Committee here had moved that to 10 years. That's a reasonable number. Clearly, I think tracking it for the entire life of the employee is burdensome to the employer. and unrealistic.
And that account's going to build up with not really any significant liabilities for a long time until finally you start getting those people retired.
Let me back up a little bit. Okay. There would be really no liability applied to the health reimbursement arrangement. It's like an employer-funded savings account,
right,
for the employee's health care costs, either to help them with the premium or help them with direct medical payments. I guess that's exactly what it is.
So we'll have, and I hadn't realized this is the case, we'll have the unfunded liability of the current system out there in whatever amount, and we'll have this growing savings account. Can I use the savings account for this new tier to pay off that unfunded liability in the old one?
No, we cannot. Assume we go in and create a new defined contribution plan. We got no savings accounts, and they each have their own individual directed account like SBS. We cannot take any of those monies, those contributions, back against the unfunded liability.
Why not?
Because the unfunded liability is the responsibility of the employer, not the employee. So we cannot assess, like I'm a tier two. The employer cannot assess tier two or tier one a percent of payroll to go into the unfunded liability of the current tier structure.
I apologize for so slowness. Well, then how does this fix our $5 billion problem? Okay.
The $5 billion underfunding, or 5.7. Can I answer that a little bit? Let me take you into the tier board structure.
Yeah.
Because this proposal, or the bill, Senate Bill 141, no matter if we're looking at state affairs or the finance person, is not, or never was intended, to recapitalize the unfunded liability. In other words, it's not, that's a separate problem and a separate issue, how to grapple with that.
I'm sorry for being slow. I thought that's what we were here to solve, but it's a different issue. And
they're a connected issue.
Okay. I'll get it as it goes.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Croft, Representative Weirach.
But I see that. I appreciate that is a separate issue. 141 is we're establishing a benchmark for a different class of employees that's coming into state service or public service, the Tier 4.
Correct, and restructuring the board and fixing the structural challenges.
We're starting a new sort of, we're going on from there. But I wanted to get to the central point, it seems to me, of what the State Affairs Committee did, and that is when they did their side-by-side comparison, they said that the Senate Bill 141 now doesn't address and, in fact, contributes to an unfunded liability. So we don't, even if we set aside we're not addressing the unfunded liability, we're creating a separate unfunded liability here that we are trying to get away from with the original system.
That's totally inaccurate.
So that's what I wanted. If that was a premise, that I wanted to get your input on.
Yeah, it's totally inaccurate. The way you get an unfunded liability is one, not funded, or two, underfunded, either through contributions too low or your market's dropping, your assets dropping. There is a liability for an employee that retires to furnish his health insurance costs at age 65. If you didn't fund it at all, then I think you'd be on point, but that would be an unfunded liability. We are, in fact, funding that as we go forward. The question is, you know, do you completely get away from and have an assurance that you'll never have an overfunding or an underfunding position? No. Is it funded every year? Yes. And the magnitude of what we're dealing with here relative to what we're dealing with the new tier and the health insurance that we're obligated to pay for the new employees when they're 65 is substantially different from the tier structures that we pay for today, which we cover 100% of the insurance today. Medical costs for tier 1, 2, and 3, depending on your age. Does that answer your question?
I guess so, but it seems maybe, I don't know. I don't think it's such a divergence from the earlier that now I don't know why there was that earlier testimony that would, and here's that it absolutely is false. It's 180 degrees. You have to believe one or the other.
Right.
The other thing is it makes me wonder, do we need something more than simply statutory language that says you shall not have an unfunded liability in your retirement program, that there has to be some sort of constitutional requirement that the legislature fund it so we don't end up into this, that we simply have to make sure we don't have an unfunded liability so we don't get into the political rhetoric. It's actually a matter of math.
I think we already have it. As we speak today. The it's grossly misleading at best to say that we're going to have an insurance obligation, a health insurance obligation for the new employees at age 65 and have an unfunded liability. The only way we're going to have an unfunded liability is if you don't, again, you don't contribute to it, or if you have a debacle like it currently is. The only other way to do it is not to offer the insurance, and clearly all different combinations of the state affairs, the Senate finance and House finance, all furnish health insurance. And the issue of, you know, is it possible or is there any risk of an underfunding? And as long as you have an obligation out in front of you, there's always that risk. What you want to do is control it and manage it. The issue okay, you want to address that? Yeah, I'll have Miles address it in a little different way, Representative Wyrock, and then I'll go on to the boards. Would that be all right?
That's right. Go ahead. Go ahead, Miles.
Through the chair, for the record, Miles Baker, staff to Senator Stedman. I think if I understand Representative Wyrock's question, the issue is Representative Seaton, in his previous testimony, made the comment that because the House Finance CS is changing the medical contribution from 3.75% to 1.75%, that those lowering that by 2% is not going to pay for the benefits that are currently, the medical benefit that's currently in the bill. And that's not our interpretation of the numbers that we've run. And Mercer's run numbers for us. I've, as recently as yesterday, on the new bill, the language that's in the new bill, and, you know, there can be a little bit of dispute depending on whose numbers you're looking at, but our understanding of the medical benefit that's in the version of the bill you have, if it's funded at 1.75% of payroll, that's sufficient to fund that benefit.
Okay. That answer your question.
And let me add, the benefit is from age 65 onwards. No matter what the growth rate is, the split is, you know, if you have the state picks up 80 and the employee picks up 20, it's always 80-20. Does that clarify at all? It's a difference because the Senate, or excuse me, the House State Affairs had a pre-65 split coverage, and also they handled post-65 differently. If I could maybe move on to the next issue, and that is the board structure. The board structure, I think, if I could back up for a minute, I think I first saw the changes today, the Finance CS. I think it's very workable. And if I can touch a little bit on the boards, there's the issue of philosophical issue of pre and post 65 healthcare costs after retirement. The next big issue is how to handle the board as far as composition. And one thing that I think we need to remember is that the new board is not the old board. The old boards, the TERS and PERS boards, spend 80% of their time on appeals. That appeal process has moved over to the administrative law judge area. And the other two things that the current boards do is set the employer contribution rate and the accept the actuarial recommendations for the actuary. Those two items are put into the new board because they're handling the assets and liabilities. And the charge of the new board is to not only take care of the assets, but to monitor the liabilities and to eventually get the assets and liabilities in balance and continue or to go forward and work on some cost containments, especially on the liability side. But when we look at who owns the liability or who's the deep pocket, who has the ultimate responsibility, or to Representative Croft's comment, who pays, it's the employer. Therefore, if the employer, and again we're looking at the current tiers, if the employer has the obligation to meet the benefit structure out in front of them, the employer then should have the ability to have input on the board and the decisions being made by that board. It doesn't matter to the employee under the current tier structure, tiers 1, 2, and 3 for PERS and tiers 1 and 2 for TERS, if the assets make 15% or negative 15%, if the liabilities grow at 8% or they grow at 2%. They have a set benefit out in front of them, and the state's going to meet its obligation no matter what. And we're going to meet that obligation. Right now we're in an underfunded position. Hopefully in the future we'll take care of that. But that obligation is going to be met. So the issue of professional standards to be met or by board members was put in. The idea there was to have board members that have more of a or an in-depth understanding of to comprehend the asset side and the liability side, or at least one side and be able to simulate into the other side. You need to have board members that understand the impact of the decisions being made. To understand if they lower the contribution rate to the employer below the normal service cost, it's going to have huge impacts, because not all good years, or not every year is a good year in the financial markets. And we've got to get the good years and the bad years washed out, amongst other things. So the board was set up. There was an issue brought up earlier about there's three board members that are not, the language is that they're not PERS and TERS members. And that's true. We looked at it as independent members. And I think when you look around the country, there's a huge push for independent boards. Also, I'd like to put forth the point that it's not only the employees, but it's every citizen in the state of Alaska is responsible collectively for the obligation being met. And clearly those people should be represented. Like today, as we sit here and deal with the situation at hand, it's not just the employer, it's the state in its entirety and all its financial assets are either at risk or can be to meet this obligation. That's why we will meet the obligation. Most of the members, other than the three, the other six members will be either TERS or PERS members, just because they are either work for the school systems, work for the state, or the commissioners. So the PERS and TERS flavor is embedded in the board structure. I think that there was some confusion, the state affairs possibly, of what the board actually does. I think in the future, and the future means 20 years out, if we go to the new tier, right now we've got roughly 100,000 if you add up everybody that could be in the plan and is in the plan and is retired. It's actually 104 last year. If you look at those folks, and there's zero in the new plan, when that is shifted and maybe there's 40% in the new tier and 60% left in the old tiers, or vice versa, as that new tier builds up and the old tiers die down, then I think the board structure should come back, be reviewed, and be changed. But currently, when the employer has to meet such an obligation, they need to have a strong seat at the table, because it's a faith and good faith and credit of the state of Alaska that's going to back it. regardless of, again, the investment performance or growth rates of health care. To the employee, that's irrelevant.
Question?
Yeah, on that issue, on the defined contribution, which everybody's, well, I guess you guys had at 3.5, I mean 4.5, 3.5, is there a set interest rate for that, or is the Cruise Tour, the new board, managing that money? I get the interest after I've contributed. I worked for 30 years here, heaven forbid, and then retire out and say I've been contributing this amount, or you guys have been contributing on my behalf. I get the 4.5% plus interest that's set, or interest that depends on the competence of the board and their investment decisions over the last 30 years.
That's a good question. The structure will be similar on the surface to SBS, where the board, that's another reason to have a professional board, is you want to steer the employees to financial success. You don't want to put them out in the mist and, you know, tell them good luck, you worked 30 years, you know, we're done with you. So if we set up the professional board to take care of the liabilities and assets today and structure the portfolios going forward for the new employees, they will come back with several selections of canned investments. There will not be the ability to go out and buy individual stocks and bonds and go out and play the penny stocks or NASDAQ. Or it will be like SBS, where you can have a money market account, a bond fund, a balanced fund, 60% stocks and bonds. There's a request by Representative Seaton, I think it's a good one, to have a portfolio that mirrors the asset allocation of the current tier structure. So if a new employee wants the portfolio that the state has for the new tier, for the old tier structure, he can have that, which will be a little more aggressive in the balanced fund, and then maybe an S&P 500 fund. So with the default being a balanced fund.
So I can't tell you to go out and buy IBM. It's my money, but I can't tell you what to buy necessarily.
Correct. So if you put in $100 and just say you'd have five selections, you'd have directly no influence to tell the portfolio manager as the employee to buy IBM. It's just like PERS. Excuse me, just like SBS today. And most of us contribute to SBS. And you get the reports, and it shows what they hold. And if you don't like what they hold, you go to the other one. Because if you had the employees, which a lot of them aren't familiar with, due to lack of interest, no knowledge, you know, just don't want to deal with it.
Yes, you said it's irrelevant to the employee. I guess it makes a great deal of difference to me as an employee what they allow me to do and what they do. It's not that all the liability falls on the government. If the board makes wrong decisions or limits my choices in wrong ways, they've affected what I'm going to be able to take out 30 years from now. And so I have an interest, because of the defined contribution character of the plan, in having my employee representatives just as much as the employer, because while the decisions the board makes are going to affect employer liability, they're going to affect what I get to take out 30 years from now.
I would agree. To the most part, right in the beginning of it, I wasn't sure if you were talking about the defined benefit plan today. If we just isolate that out and look at the defined contribution plan, clearly the employee in a defined contribution plan should have the ability to influence the selection. Yeah, so, you know, the mix and stuff like that. But currently, we have no employees in the group. And we've got these other 100,000 people we're dealing with. So that's why I'm saying, as time goes on, and maybe it's 10 years when you want to go back, or 5 years or some time, and start addressing that issue. Or there could be an employee, new tier, you know, advisory board that advises them. But there's no intent to have a defined contribution plan in the future with the employees not being able to be represented on their investment selections.
In fact, at some point it switches all the way over to where the government has relatively little interest left. They're a savings account, and it should be all employee people on the board.
I would agree 100% with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
The only other liability then that the employer would have to pay attention to is that health care. But that may be 25 years when that happens, when we're retired. Clearly that day will come. But we're trying to set the board up to the issue at hand, which is the $5.7 billion, which leads into the next piece. In that question is, why isn't it in this bill? The reason is the Senate, and everybody can draw their own opinions and conclusions, but the Senate Finance Committee decided that it was going to have the structural fix first, rather than throw money at the problem, fix the structural problem, the new board, and the new tier structure, then ask the new board to come, go out, look at the situation, come back with cost controls and recommendations to deal with the funding challenges we have with the $5.7 billion. And then next year, I'm sure that big gorilla is going to be let out of a closet here in the room, and we're going to have to wrestle with him.
Did Everson Kelly,
do you have a
question?
Okay, Everson Crop.
Well, it's that issue that's still posing me. I thought we were going to hear about the gorilla today. I thought 141 was... And I'm still, I guess, confused how we could build up a multi-billion-dollar savings account, have a debt, and not have them have any way to cancel each other out. If this doesn't cure our current financial hole in our retirement system, what should we do about that? Because that's what I thought we were going to address here over the next week.
Yeah.
What is the solution?
The solution is, first, to come in with a structural fix.
But we can't. They can't affect it, you just said.
But wait a minute, let me finish. A structural fix, because the challenge that we face is so large that we can't throw tens of millions or hundreds of millions at it. It's going to be like a big black hole. It's going to suck up a lot of capital. We need to get our structural fix first, plug the leak in the barrel, and then go after the $5.7 billion. The problem, if we just do it in my opinion, go in with a quick financial fix and leave what I consider as a broken system in place, a few years from now, we could be sitting right back with the same type of large underfunded mess as we have today. That's why it's broken into two components, and I think it's much easier conceptually for people to deal with, including myself, to compartmentalize it into two major sections. One of them is fix the leaks in the barrels, do the structural fix, and then once that's done, switch our focus on the unfunded issue. And I'm not saying to completely make it disappear, but I think definitely take some steps to alleviate the ratcheting effect and the contribution burden of the employers going forward. Another finance committee may decide to reverse it, try to fix the financial mess first and then do the structural part. But I'd argue the hole is so big, if you don't fix the structural part first, you can be throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into the abyss. And don't forget, last year we made 15% on the portfolio and we went backwards $700 million. It's not... They're just big numbers, and they're going to impact us. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hoffman.
That line brings a question in my mind. Is it your priority structural fix? And basically, just say, whatever's in the past, we're just going to have to, somewhere along the way, we're going to have to fire away out of that front door. The structural fix. We've been, over the course of time, we had a multi-tier system. There's been fixed attempts made with tier three and tier two and third. And I'm just wondering, do we know for certain, do we absolutely know that those past structural fixes are not in fact a substantial remediation of our problem if we took away the obvious problems with the escalating costs and the previous tiers? Do we have any stratified this? Do we know is our problem tier 1, 2, and 3, or is tier 3 itself going to blow up on us, and to what degree is it going to blow up on us?
I think if you dissected it like that, you'd find that, or I'd expect to find tier 1 is more challenging than tier 2. Basically, it's because it's more expensive and a richer plan. And tier 2 is more expensive than tier 3. I think if we were entirely under tier 3, we wouldn't have the magnitude of the problem we have. We'd still have the challenge. I think the issue, in my opinion, is having a defined benefit plan that is so inelastic, we cannot respond easily to changing market conditions, if it's financial market conditions or healthcare market conditions. And when we look at when these retirement mechanisms were set up, we got to go clear back to statehood, and even some of the ties go back pre-statehood, and it's in the Constitution. And I certainly don't fault the people that sat in this building and worked hard in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. There's no way that they could contemplate the growth of healthcare that we saw in the late 90s and coming into the beginning of the century. So I would just point that with the demographic changes and which leads into healthcare growth changes and financial market changes, the game's completely different today than it was in 1960 or 1970.
Tier 3 came in, that wasn't that long ago, and it was an attempt at a structural fix.
Correct.
I'm not quite sure we really do have the information in front of us to know how effective or how flawed from Tier 3 is. I mean, that's something we as a committee have to satisfy ourselves with, is just how broken are we under the current tier? Or do we have to overcompensate because Tier 1 is so much of a problem? We've got to overcompensate and deny a level of benefits that would be sustainable, say, potentially if it was just a Tier 3 and the other problems would go away. Again, I don't think we can answer that here. We don't have the information in front of us, which leads me to another point that I want to go through briefly here. You mentioned repeatedly Mercer's run numbers for you, Mercer's done various modeling on your behalf. To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe that this committee's had the benefit of any assistance. I don't know if it's been proffered, or do you have to hire Mercer to do your analysis, or how did you gain access to that resource?
Through the Department of Benefits.
And so is that being paid for out of the assets of the plan now?
We'd have to bring Ms. Millie Milhorn forward. The state pays roughly around $450,000 a year, plus or minus a few thousand to Mercer. They're basically on retainer, and I would imagine that they'll send us a bill equal to their historic bills anyway.
Last conference, obviously this committee's not had the advantage, so would it be responsible for us, Mercer was the horse we rode into this proper one, would it be responsible, I'm learning from Mr. Kelly, would it be responsible for us to have a second opinion for our committee to utilize the services of some, equally credible and reputable to sort of have, truly have a vet check on, because right now it seems to me sort of we rode this horse in on the first Mercer. They've been the ones that seem to have driven the debate and the various minutes of peer committees and the research I've been able to do. Certainly they've been the single resource for anything that's gone before this committee. And as complex and challenging as this issue is, and as vested in interest as that company has, I worry about it. Should we have someone that is truly independent of our existing players providing at least if not counsel to us as a finance committee in the House of Representatives, give the public a sense that we have in fact taken a second look, or we're going to have a second opinion before we submit this plan to the surgery.
I think when you look at the analysis done by Mercer over the last several months, certainly all the members of the committee are welcome to all of it. Either we have copies, or you guys can get copies from the department. the issue, you know, have we spoken with anybody other than Mercer? The answer to that is yes. We've used models different from Mercer. Answer, you know, to that point. Mercer's numbers have been checked. Questions we ask, but through Milliman USA's audit a couple of years ago, and so forth. But you know, I can't sit here from the other body and I certainly wouldn't presume to tell the chairman or recommend to the chairman how he wants to run the committee. And all I can say is we're willing to share whatever information we have, all of it, and we don't have any secrets. And the results, when they run them, you can hire a different company. The results may be a little bit different, but it's going to be awful close. And if we can get the direction and the magnitude correct in this game, that's about the best you can do. You certainly can't.
This is just a mechanical decision. We figured we'd put variables and that's to get an answer.
Not quite that simple, because there is some differences of opinion of future healthcare costs. And you know, so you get a banded result. As a good example, last year at the end of the fiscal year, they told us the deficit, you know, was in the fund was in the entirety $5.7 billion. It's going to be a range up in around that area. So we're working with ranges. And clearly, another thing that was mentioned earlier, $50,000 out in the future for health insurance costs. One of the things we've got to remember when we deal with this is that if you use a future value out 20 or 30 years, you need to move it back to today's dollars, or you got to move everything today out into the future. $50,000 in 30 years is not the same today. And you get huge distortions unless you work at one point in time. And most people work in today's dollars, move everything today, but you can, if you want, move everything forward.
Well, I guess I don't want to get into too much debate, but others have a phenomenon of this escalating medical cost factor. Mm-hmm. And it's that factor that, you know, if you truly compound, you know, the actuary business, the projection business, we know the growth costs. Mm-hmm. There's no good increase. And we keep compounding them. And it doesn't take us, just using the, you know, the law of, you know, the magic of compounding numbers, before the medical cost component of our retirement plan in Alaska exceeds the entire, you know, gross domestic product of the state. And, you know, there's something counterintuitive there. I mean, that level of inflation cannot continue forever, or else we're going to have a much bigger problem on our hands than the pension plan.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that? If we back up a little bit and take that point, and it's a good point that Representative Parker brought up, and looked at it at the national level, if healthcare costs continue to grow as it's grown in the past, it's going to consume the whole country's GDP eventually. I mean, at some point in time, it's going to have to level off or decline. And I think that leads into points made earlier in the previous presentation that if you're going to do a financial fix, the financial fix shouldn't be write a check for $5.7 billion, because part of this problem we can work our way out of. In the future, we'll probably have an active debate over what that amount is and how much should we, you know, should we address $2 billion of the problem, $3 billion of the problem. Clearly, I think, and I certainly don't want to speak for Rep. Walker, I would be very surprised if he sat in his chair and argued for a fix of 5.7. I know I wouldn't.
You read me very well, sir. But that's, it's sharing a frustration that we do have at the time, and Senator Stedman and myself. But I mean, we've gone absolutely 100% in line. I truly believe we are completely in line with the beneficiaries of the plan. The problem here is medical cost growth. Getting folks to the table to truly address, and I just want to make sure that whatever we do, we must address this medical cost component within these, from all sides, from cost management, and not just in my opinion, not just in either denying benefits or increasing the burden on employees.
That is what
workers' comp, Medicaid, and our retirement issues. There's one huge common thread. If our bodies have a challenge, this is going to be the one that's being smart enough to get the ones that figure out medical cost growth.
Mm-hmm.
That is why the Senate took the Senate Finance Committee took the philosophical position. When the employee quits after and ends their service, the state starts picking up a portion and a majority of the portion of the insurance cost at age 65. And it was a cost containment method item. And currently, the there's under tier 2 and 3, it's age, age 60. It's cost control. We'd all like to be able to sit here and give tier 1 to everybody, but we just can't. We just can't afford it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And in all fairness, we haven't asked for any money or any numbers to be run, but I'm sure Mr. Neil Horn would do that if this committee needs or wants the numbers run. Representative Kelly.
Just a few closing remarks, and I really appreciate the comments here and the hard work done by Representative Seaton and Senator Stedman and their staffs and their committees, because they've been slugging it out. It's been hard work. We're down here with, looks to me like a little over 10 days to go, so we're not going to restudy much of very much in that time frame. One of my concerns is if we don't get a new plan in place, kind of the stop the leak, something's kicked a hole in the bottom, and if we don't go down and stuff something into it to stop the leak, we're going to stand up 5,500 new employees, according to retirement benefits people. We're going to stand them up in the next year if it mirrors past years. That's people that retire, they're fired, they quit, however, and new employees. And that's about, I think, just shy of 15% of the workforce, which is not a bad number. A lot of people think that was a pretty good turnover rate. So I'm very concerned, Mr. Chairman, that we act, and I think that in the House we've had a considerable amount of work done that has come to what I would argue is a very similar conclusion to what all the work in the Senate drove to. And I would argue that after sitting between the two committees in examining how far apart they are, I'm going to hazard as somebody that's watched a little bit of this in my other lives, that they're very close together. I would say if you kick Paul and Representative Seaton and Senator Stedman in the room and shut the door and knock the food off, we'd have them out of there in about 24 hours. So I really think that we're close in that regard. We don't want to stand up 5,500 new problems. I would argue that the horse we rode in on, just a little different from Representative Hawker, on the analogy, the horse we rode in on was not named Mercer. The horse we rode in on was named DB, and it's the same horse that about 50 other states have been riding, and they're having real difficult problems with that mount. And you will see dramatic changes in the next decade, not just us. I'm happy, very happy, unlike the collapse of the Western Teamsters system, a retirement system years ago, or even the situation with the Alaska situation with that union, with which I'm very familiar, where it had terrific impacts on existing people. We don't affect one single employee, not a single retiree. We are only addressing someone that comes to the front door and says, I'd like to go to work here. I'm responding to an application. So I think that is a very fortunate circumstance for us as we sit here. I would argue that we've heard a lot from people that don't want to see us stand up a new plan that's a defined contribution. I don't think we've heard very much at all from the other Alaskans, half a million of them out there, that aren't affected by this but that have to pay for it. I think we've heard some, and it's been very consistent when we've heard it from the employers, that they can't pay a third to a half of their wages to handle this unfunded liability. They, just like private business, they can't do it. They go under. So we owe them a voice at this table in addition to the other voices. I would argue, based on some experience, and both in the private sector and looking at the plan, the ESBS plan, and talking to some of the young folks that around here, that attracting and retaining with the DC is absolutely, unarguably, in my opinion, something that can be done and can be done just as well, if not better, than with the DB. And if we undershoot with the DC, zippers on this, on the healthcare reimbursement, there's zipper on it on the employer contribution. We can run those up if we have to attract and retain. So I would just encourage you as we go into the last days to remember that we have a real problem here that we can't, in my opinion, we shouldn't stand up 5,500 new or 12 to 15% of the workforce to continue the problem, and that I would encourage us to take a look at what Representative Seaton's committee's done, what Senator Stedman's committee's done, bring these things together and get on with this, Mr. Chairman. Just my opinion.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kelly. Any other questions for Senator Stedman? What I'd like to do is, I don't know if Melanie wants to make any comments on where we're at today, but you are with the Division of Retirement Benefits, so this ultimately impacts you. You don't have to comment if you don't want to, so I'm just giving you an opportunity if you wanted to say anything. And then we'll after Ms. Milhorn, we'll conclude with the one person I've allowed or agreed to let testify if she's still online. We'll conclude.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And I just want to say that the division is well prepared to help finance the members here. If there's any questions, if there's any body of our current data that you're interested in, we are ready to provide you with that resource and that assistance. I think I share Representative Kelly's comments that Senate Finance and House State Affairs did a huge amount of work. I think that they are very close together, and I just want to lend our support to this effort. I think it's very important, and thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for sitting through all the. Oh, Melanie, please. Can you, Melanie? Okay, we have a question. And I want to thank you, too, because I know you've been sitting through all these meetings, both on the House side and the Senate side, and there's been some long ones. Representative Croft.
Yeah, it's the question I asked Senator Stedman before, but we've heard a lot about what we do going forward. How are there proposals out there that I've missed, or how should we address the current $5.7 billion liability? What do we do about that?
Through the Chair, Representative Croft, what the new plan does right now, whatever comes out of House Finance, what that plan is designed to do is it provides a long-term solution, because it takes out the volatility associated with the defined benefit plan, and after approximately 13, 14 years, what it does is the employer contribution rate that would be expected to rise starts to go down instead toward the end. That's why it's considered a long-term solution. And when you get to the end of that continuum, it's a 25-year amortized schedule. What you do is you retire the unfunded liability. So by introduction of a new defined contribution plan, as set out with Senate Bill 141, it brings in a new tier. It deals with volatility associated with investment returns and health care costs. It eliminates that volatility, and it brings in a new normal cost with a new tier that pays off the unfunded liability over that 25-year period. What happens is your new normal cost would be established, and then you would see the line go flat, because you do not have the elements associated with volatility in a defined benefit plan. So what it does is it allows for a long-term solution.
Well, that seems to contradict before, and I'm still confused. I thought we couldn't use any of the assets we're going to be collecting from the defined contribution to pay off what we owe on the prior. So if not, if it doesn't provide a source of funding for that, where does that money come from?
where that money comes from through the chair, Representative Croft, that money comes from the employer. The employer will be paying for the past service cost associated with the unfunded liability. They own that obligation. The new introduction of a new tier with a normal cost that does not have a past service liability attaching to it is the introduction of a new tier. It's that new tier design is attached to the existing tiers in the sense that it brings in a new normal cost rate that doesn't have a past service rate attached to it. The employer pays off the past service rate. After that 25-year period, you've retired the unfunded liability and you go to a normal cost rate that is between 8 and 8.5%. And because you've eliminated the volatility in a DB plan, it is not expected at all that that 8 to 8.5% would go through what we're going through right now. We're almost at 28% for PERS into the future, and it's going to be, it's 41 right now for TERS, and that's expected for TERS to go up to very nearly 50 and very nearly 40 for PERS. That is what is being eliminated by going to the new tier design with the defined contribution plan.
We eliminate our risk as an employer.
Correct.
Just note, we don't really eliminate it so much as transfer it, but it is, does go off our books. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Croft. Any other questions for Ms. Milhorn? Seeing none. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Milhorn. Okay. One person to testify, and then we'll conclude tonight's meeting. Let's see. This is a Rose. Is Rose still with us? Okay.
Yes, I am.
You got a lot of patience.
Thank you.
And I understand the only reason why I'm letting you testify here is the Teamsters were not represented on Saturday. We did hear a lot of testimony on Saturday. In fact, start at 10, I think, 6 o'clock before we were finished. And we did, on Saturday, ask people to keep their testimony very short and concise. And so I would ask the same of you. You can try to keep it under 3 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. My name is Rose Calamaritas, and I'm the administrator of the Teamsters retirement plan and also in charge of their medical plan. And I've listened to the testimony today. It's been very interesting, and I've learned quite a bit. I don't know a lot about the TERS and PERS retirement system because I'm dealing with our retirement plan, and we work in the private sector. The funding issues are a little different than they are in the private or in the public sector. I did sit through the testimony on Saturday, and there was a lot of very heartfelt testimony from people who were directly impacted, and I'm not one of those people. I'm not impacted by House or Senate Bill 141 in as much as I don't have a retirement plan with the state, nor do I expect to have one. I think there needs to be a real specific distinction, though, in this discussion about funding for the retirement plan and the type of retirement plan you have for annuity payments versus the medical plan. And I think that the changes that have been proposed that I've listened to today, some of those are good changes. I think, in fact, the state could even go further and look more like the private sector. The health benefits still for retirees still look very generous to give someone benefits at 65 after they've worked 10 years and left at age 30 is something you wouldn't normally see in the private sector. So that's the perspective that I'm coming here with. But when it comes to retirement benefits, I think you have to really carefully consider whether you want to change the benefits for future public employees from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. I think if you look at the funding issues and you separate those from the cost of the medical, if you look totally at the retirement portion, I'm not sure there's a lot of cost savings there by switching it to a defined contribution plan. There is some. I know there is because the funding mechanisms are entirely different. But what you're doing is you're simply shifting the risk from the employer to the employee. In a defined benefit plan, you smooth that risk out over the whole fund. The fund works to to get investment returns to fund the benefits that are promised. You define a benefit, you can tell people what they can expect at retirement. In a defined contribution plan, you can't do that because they have the individuals have their own account, and they take they have contributions into those accounts, and then they take the investment risk, which means whatever they have at the end of their career is the contributions to that account plus or minus the investment return. So it really depends on how they've invested those monies. And I know there's statistics out there. I'm sure you've heard about them already. There was a study that was done by Wilson Wyatt that showed, and I've seen these statistics over the years, the rate of investment return on defined benefit plans are higher than they are on defined contribution plans, and that's because individuals just, you know, they don't have the sophistication to make good investment decisions, and they often make very conservative investment decisions. You know, if they have a list of five different funds to choose from, I've seen 20-year-olds pick bond funds instead of picking at that age. They should be picking, you know, growth funds and value funds, but they don't understand that. Even if they have really good fund assistance, and all these funds have people to advise them, they're afraid to take, or maybe they're afraid of looking stupid, so they don't take that advice. Don't even seek it out. They just make these decisions and hope for the best. But at the end of their career, if they don't have enough assets to cover their what they need in retirement, to cover the long-term stream of payments, they're going to end up running out of assets, and then they're going to end up, you know, somebody's going to have to pay for their expenses, and it's probably going to be the public again. I think that when you look at some of the changes that you guys have proposed, or you folks have proposed on the health plan, I think one of the things I would caution you maybe to do is look at the private sector and look what employers out here are doing with retirement health plans. This is a very, very generous retirement health plan, and maybe you need to just spend a little more time on that and try to if there's any way to leave the defined benefit plan in place for future employees, it would certainly attract better state employees. If I were a teacher looking at a job with the state of Alaska that offers a defined contribution plan, or anywhere else that provides secure benefits I can really bank on and know what to expect, I would certainly pick the defined benefit plan over the defined contribution plan. But that's really what I wanted to offer today. I don't know if I kept it under the 3 minutes. I had a whole lot more to say that I could have said here today, but I understand you guys have worked really hard. You've had a lot of good advice, and this really goes to a philosophical issue about what kind of an employer the state wants to be. Do you want to be an employer that provides long-term benefits to your employees? I'm talking about retirement benefits. Or do you want to provide a supplemental type retirement plan, which is what defined contribution retirement plans are? Again, the health benefits I think are a different issue, and I think there's even more that could be changed on that, and you would still be providing great benefits for your career retirees, and I think that's what you need to look at. I don't believe, as people of the state of Alaska, and we all do pay for this, I think Mr. Stedman said that, I don't think you have an obligation to someone who works for 10 years in their 20s, but you do have an obligation to someone who works 30 years and retires from the system. So thank you for your time. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay. I don't see any questions, Rose. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I'd love to let you continue on, but we've had a lot of people who've asked to testify, and at some point in time, you got to say, enough's enough.
Thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. We've heard a lot today and Saturday and throughout the session on this issue. I think we have a lot of experts. Okay. We have a lot of experts. People put a lot of time into this issue. I know Representative Kelly worked hard on it. Representative Hawker's worked hard on it. Senator Stebbins certainly has worked extremely hard on it. Representative Seaton's worked hard on it. And I think there's a solution here. But what I'm going to ask is that you guys get together and try to bring us this solution. You know, we could try to do it here in committee and make all sorts of amendments and have all sorts of discussions and be here for days, I'm afraid. What I'm hoping is that we'll set up a work group here and give you guys till Saturday to come back with a what you think is a workable solution, and then bring it back before this committee, and we'll discuss it. Hopefully, it's something that this committee can approve and pass on. So the and obviously too, we'll have Representative Seaton will help, I'm sure, if you want to have his expertise on all the work that they've done in state affairs. Senator Stedman, I'm sure, will be available for any questions. I know Ms. Milhorn's already offered her time and effort and even financial resources if need to be. So what I'd like is to have Representative Parker, Representative Wyrock, Representative Kelly, and is it Representative Croft or George?
I guess Croft.
Representative Croft, okay. I'd like to have you four try to get together in the next 48 hours and come back with some, and pull a rabbit out of your hat, I guess, and come back with what you recommend. And I'd like to have Representative Kelly, who's not here, but I have spoken to him, chair this committee. And so with that, is there anything else that you need to bring up? Okay.
I just offer that that's a large order for
I know.
What people do in 2 days that's taking the rest of this body 2 years to get to the point.
I understand, and that may be your recommendation on Saturdays, is that you could do it, but I think that you all have the desire and want to.
Couldn't you at least give us a session in church on Sunday?
That's where you might pray for your sins.
Okay, so with that then, we'll just stand recessed until tomorrow morning, where we are taking up some more bills. These are House bills that need to get moving. House Bill 272, House Bill 217, and HCR 6 in the morning. If you think we're doing any good to have any more discussion on this tomorrow afternoon, we can, but I'd just assume let the committee, or subcommittee, or work committee do your thing, and then we'll take that back up Saturday. So then at 1:30, we'll just take up some more bills, combination of House and Senate bills. So with that, anything else? If not, then we'll recess till tomorrow morning.
So does